The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. This is Judge Greenberg. I'm joined by Judges Toth and Jaquith. We are convened today via video conference to consider the arguments in the matter of Greenidge against McDonough, case number 207820. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, make your appearances, please?
Kenneth Carpenter and Glenda Hurl appearing on behalf of Mr. Greenidge.
Matt Showalter.
Go ahead.
Matt Showalter and Mark Pichich appearing on behalf of the secretary.
Thank you. Would counsel for the appellant like to reserve time for
rebuttal? 10 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you. If counsel are ready, we'll begin with the appellant. Mr. Carpenter, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter appearing on behalf of Mr. Mike Greenidge. I believe it's fair to say that at first glance, it does not appear that the Federal Circuit's decisions in Burkhart can be reconciled with the Federal Circuit's later decisions in Hudson and Halpern. I believe, however, upon further consideration of the matter, that these cases can be distinguished and are, in fact, distinguishable. The question addressed in Burkhart was a narrower issue that concerned only the general question of whether or not this court had correctly interpreted the jurisdictional requirements for the Aegis statute, which the Federal Circuit affirmed. However, in making that affirmance, the Federal Circuit relied exclusively upon its own precedent in a non-VA case, in a case called John Manville, which determined that the claims court had dismissed an action that was pending before it, and based upon that dismissal, the court then lacked jurisdiction to consider the EJA application that was pending. However, the Federal Circuit in Johns Manville, did not and was not applying the same criteria for jurisdiction that is applicable in this case. The critical matter to this panel and the panel in Bernhardt is that no analysis was made or comparison between the underlying jurisdiction for the claims court and the underlying jurisdiction for this court. As a result, that issue was overlooked by the Federal Circuit in Burkhart, and that is the clear distinction that exists between the subsequent cases that were decided in Hudson and Halpern. The panel in Burkhart did not address the critical distinction that exists between the claims court's jurisdiction, which is a jurisdiction of original jurisdiction, meaning that the cause of action was filed directly with the claims court without any prior proceedings, as opposed to the jurisdiction of this court, which is predicated upon an adverse final decision of the Board of Veterans Appeals. That distinction is critical because in the later panel cases in Hudson and Halpern, the Federal Circuit did recognize that this court did have jurisdiction in both Hudson and Halpern, as it in fact did in Burkhart. And that distinction is that in Burkhart and in the later decisions, there was a failure to recognize that this court's jurisdiction is predicated upon a different statutory standard.
Yes, so this might be a good place to hop in, because this is a bit of an unusual argument in that it's almost more like a conference. You know, the parties have agreed to kind of come back for us to sort of revisit this and sort of consider kind of Halpern and Burkhart. It strikes me reading Hudson and Halpern that the issue that the Federal Circuit seems to be struggling with is something like the concept of derivative jurisdiction, right? That our jurisdiction is derivative of the board such that anytime the board is held for lack of notice or anything to lack jurisdiction, we automatically lose jurisdiction at the same time. right?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree with that.
Well, no. I mean, which is fine. I mean, but so, for instance, in the original MEMDEC, in the original decision, I cite a case called Braun, which basically says if the board issues a decision without jurisdiction, if the board issues a decision without jurisdiction, the court also lacks jurisdiction and thus does not have the authority to remand. That's from a case called Braun from 2016. Yes. Is that viable? I mean, do we have to overrule that, basically?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe you do, because Braun, like the decision in Burkhart, deals with the basic proposition of whether or not this court can have jurisdiction if the board did not have jurisdiction. That is a separate question from which is presented in this case and was presented in Hudson and Halperin, which is whether or not this court did in fact have jurisdiction. In both of those cases, the Federal Circuit found—
That's kind of my point. I mean, I'm sort of agreeing with you in a roundabout way, which is we can't both exercise jurisdiction, which is basically when you review a board decision, you look at it on the merits and you just say the board had no jurisdiction that itself is an exercise of jurisdiction. So the problem appears to me this idea that we kind of, and Braun wasn't the first case, I think, that said this. I mean, it's been around for a while in our case law. I mean, and I think this is sort of what Hudson is really getting at, which is the court in that case basically exercised jurisdiction. They looked at whatever the board decided. I think in that case, the regional office had never done like an SOC or something, and right. The board went ahead and decided it. You know, we looked at it. We said that, you know, that decision was ultra vires. They had no authority to make it. But then we concluded, oh, and because they lack jurisdiction, we also lack jurisdiction. Correct. And the Federal Circuit basically said, no, you're exercising jurisdiction. That's what you do when you take cases and you basically make legal rulings and legal determinations. That seems to put kind of Braun, that whole line, right in the crosshairs. And maybe we as a court just have never recognized that.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I believe that Braun, like Burkhart, was approaching it from a different, more narrow perspective, which is the generalized proposition that if a court doesn't have jurisdiction because the lower entity and or court didn't have jurisdiction, then the court can't exercise jurisdiction. To me, the distinction here is that in the statutory construction under 7252 and 7266, this court has exclusive jurisdiction to review decisions which are adverse to any person. And that adverse decision is what triggers this court's jurisdiction when there is a resulting board decision. And then when the board does, as it did in all three of these cases, incorrectly exercise its jurisdiction, whether you call it prematurely or they failed to comply with a notice requirement, regardless, they didn't act in accordance with their own jurisdiction. When that decision was made to act in excess, that then was an adverse effect upon each of those three appellants. And each of those three appellants had the ability under 7252 and 7266 to appeal that adverse result to this court, implicating this court's jurisdiction as a matter of law.
Let me ask you this. Let's say I agree with you, because I mean, I think in principle I do, right? Which is, I find the concept of this, I'll call it derivative jurisdiction, but I think it's fundamentally off. And I think that's what Halperin points out, right? If you look at 7261C3, I think, you know, basically the scope of our authority includes the authority to set aside board decision that are in excess of statutory jurisdiction. I think it's
correct.
That if our jurisdiction really were what Braun says, that would be impossible. right? We would,
Yes.
if our jurisdiction were absolutely coterminous with the board's, we would not be able to set aside, because that's an act of jurisdiction, setting aside a thing. So obviously, we've got some case law that seems to be in stark conflict with Halpern. The original, I mean, when I heard this case as a single judge, I mean, I'm bound by our case law, so I didn't give it too much thought. But now we're here, and the Federal Circuit's asked us to kind of discuss. So should we start overruling things? I mean, what should we do?
Well, I don't think it's necessary to overrule things. I think it is necessary for this panel to acknowledge that this court is controlled by the decisions in Hudson and Halpern and is not controlled by the panel decision in Braun. And that's...
May I interrupt, Mr. Carpenter? Sorry to interrupt. Yes, what is the holding you would like this court to enter?
That this court erred in its merits decision in finding that it did not have jurisdiction, and find that because this court had jurisdiction under 7266, because Mr. Greenidge was adversely affected by this board decision, that this court necessarily has jurisdiction to entertain his EJ application.
And that's resting, I take it, on the statute.
Yes.
Thank you. Proceed.
So picking up... you're saying we don't have to overrule because the Federal Circuit has effectively...
has already spoken to the issue, Your Honor.
So what about the timing? Like, because Halpern's 2003 and then Braun's 2016. Is it just a matter of we haven't recognized this?
Well, I suppose that's one way to look at it. But as I view it, an inferior tribunal cannot write a panel decision that is in conflict with the superior court, and that Hudson and Halpern control the disposition of the question before the court, and Braun does not and cannot. I understand the sort of mechanics issue of it, but I don't think it is something that is beyond this panel, because I think this panel is bound by the decisions in Halpern and Hudson, and that the reason that the Federal Circuit returned this case was for this court to specifically address that issue and to recognize that whatever precedent this court may have to the contrary is superseded by and controlled by the decisions in Halpern.
Mr.
Which
Carter,
I guess renders Braun a nullity.
Isn't there some inconsistency with Burkhart that we have to account for between it and Halpern and Hudson?
I believe there is, Your Honor, and that is the inconsistency that I tried to point out in my opening comments.
The Johns Manville situation is quite different than what was at issue in Burkhart, what's at issue here.
Absolutely,
I'm with you on that, and that it's a lack of jurisdiction when the case is improperly filed in the wrong court case. That's
right.
Not. I mean, we could all agree that if a veteran was criminally prosecuted in federal district court and thought because he was a veteran he could appeal his sentence to our court, then he'd be in the wrong place, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. So to that extent, Burkhart rests on a bad footing. But there's a little more to it than that, isn't there? Because they embrace something that our court said below. And that was that where the court dismisses an appeal because it lacks jurisdiction to award the relief sought, it also lacks jurisdiction to consider an EJ application.
Yes, Your Honor, but I don't believe that proposition applied either in Burkhart or in Hudson or Halpern, because it wasn't a question of didn't have the authority to grant the relief, this court most certainly had the authority to grant the relief. And as the Federal Circuit observed in Hudson, the error of the Veterans Court in Hudson was in saying it didn't have jurisdiction, but then essentially remanding the case for remedial proceedings. And this
doesn't that whole the whole focus on the award the relief sought aspect confuse the jurisdictional question with the merits of the with the merits question? When we're talking jurisdiction, we're talking 7252, the authority to hear the case. Isn't that right?
Yes, but 7252 has to be read in conjunction with 7266. And 7266 identifies those individuals who can get within this court's jurisdiction if they were adversely affected by a board decision. And clearly, all three of these veterans were adversely affected by the respective board decisions in each of those cases. So I don't think it's appropriate to insert the notion of the relief sought as a factor. The critical factor under 7266 is whether or not the individual claimant or veteran was adversely affected, and that this court has both the jurisdiction, authority, and responsibility to correct that adverse effect. So that injury.
Let me ask you this, because I think the technical aspects are quite important, which is, as I read Hudson, it basically says, listen, when you the act of pointing out errors in a lower tribunal's thing is itself an exercise of jurisdiction. And even though we're technically dismissing things, they're effectively remands. And that's where I think the remedy comes in. Is it a matter of, say, improper notice, right? Improper yes. notice, something we deem it pending. And so we've done this thing where we dismiss because the board lacked. Should we just be vacating the board decision with instructions
for and remanding as proper notice? And remanding is appropriate, Your Honor. Under 7252, the options given by Congress to this court are to reverse, to affirm, or to remand as appropriate. And it is in that large blanket of remand as appropriate where this court corrects the infirmity, if you will, in the decision-making made by the board, which adversely affected the veteran or the claimant.
Right, because, if you, take notice. You've appealed your, share of cases challenging the board's finding of notice, right? If we technically had, so what we tend to do with notice, this is exactly what happened in Burkhart.
Yes.
Is we say, oh, notice was not proper. The claim is pending. Therefore, the board never had jurisdiction. So we kind of play it up the line. Therefore, we lack jurisdiction, right?
Well, but Your Honor, if I may, I'm sorry, I didn't mean
to. Let me finish my thought. Because if that were really the case, we could never evaluate the notice. That's what lack of jurisdiction means. It means you lack any legal authority to actually adjudicate the matter or speak on it. And so it strikes me the whole derivative jurisdiction thing, and that's what I call it, basically. I think that's is wrong. It's just fundamentally, and that's sort of what Halpern is kind of pointing out.
Well, I certainly don't disagree with that analysis, but I would suggest to Your Honor that The issue here is this court's, you'll forgive me, improper use of dismissal. Congress did not authorize this court to dismiss.
Well, dismissal is what you have to do with a finding of lack of jurisdiction. I'm kind of one step further, which is it's the finding of a lack of jurisdiction that's the problem.
With respect, Your Honor, I believe you're skipping a step. Initial analysis has to be one of whether or not the party is properly before this court. And 7266 defines when a party is properly before this court.
I have 7266, that's notice. And you seem to be making something like a personal jurisdiction, like cause of action argument. Like, so here's how I see jurisdiction, which is you've got subject matter jurisdiction, which is basically 511, right? Does this involve veterans' benefits?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got finality, which is basically, is the board still adjudicating this? Is VA still, like, have they come to a final decision? And then once they issue a board decision, and then basically you've got some standing issues that can be jurisdictional. But basically, other than subject matter and then finality, standing. So maybe, I guess if you're not the person, you would lack standing, right? I mean, that maybe that's a way to think about it, is there's no case or controversy involving you. But that's not statutory. That's just, that would be like a standing constitutional type thing.
And jurisdiction is statutory. And jurisdiction is conferred upon this court when a claimant or veteran is adversely affected. And it just seems to me that this court has used in the broader legal context the notion of dismissal as an appropriate remedy. I'm sorry that I'm at the end of my time. I'm sorry, Judge Greenberg, again.
Add 3 minutes. All right. Did you hear me?
Thank you. Yes, yes.
This won't affect your rebuttal time, so don't take too long.
Thank you, Your Honor. The point I was trying to make is that 7266 identifies how this court has or hasn't lawful jurisdiction to hear an appeal. And each of these three veterans met that criteria. In the Burkhart decision, unfortunately, there was not enough consideration given to the differential between the claims court's jurisdiction and this court's jurisdiction. And as a result, they simply went to that generalized or global proposition relative to dismissal. This court, however, has got a very precise criteria in 7266, which permits this court to review any decision of the board which adversely affects any person, not necessarily the person that was involved in that particular decision. So a adversely affected party can also appeal to this court, even though they weren't the claimant or the appellant in that particular board decision. But to me, the critical distinction here is one in which it's important for this panel to address how to remedy the precise situation that you're describing. And dismissal should not be part of that criteria. It should be part only of the amend as appropriate criteria under 7252.
Anything, Judge Jaquith, anything further at this point for counsel?
No, thank you, Judge Greenberg.
Judge Toth, anything further at this point?
Not now. You know, I'll mention this as a kind of a play. Is I may, Mr. Carpenter, ask you about prevailing party. I know that we didn't put that in our order. So if you're not kind of prepared to go there, that's fine. But on rebuttal, I may ask you a question about that. So,
well, I can respond, Your Honor, that I don't believe it's appropriate for us to address prevailing party since the decision of this court was this court doesn't have jurisdiction to get there.
Right.
Once we establish jurisdiction, then we can discuss prevailing party. And that's a part of a separate proceeding from this proceeding, with all due respect. Right. It's just not appropriate for us to get to prevailing party. And I know the government's going to want to get there, so that they're going to be happy to discuss it with you.
Okay, we could pick it up on rebuttal. Thanks.
Yes. Thank
all
you.
All right. Counsel for the government, we'll hear from you, please.
May it please the court. The court should again dismiss appellant's EJIA application for lack of jurisdiction because the Federal Circuit's narrow holding in Halpern can be distinguished from this case for two reasons. First, this case does not involve a claim where an original jurisdiction decision was erroneous. And second, the court's order to dismiss required no further agency action. In rarer cases where there's a claim with an error in an original jurisdiction decision where the court's order requires agency action to rectify that error, the court has jurisdiction over the appeal and the EJA.
So, counsel, you probably picked up from the line of questioning before that I'm going to ask you about this, but what is original jurisdiction, right? Because I think that's kind of what Hudson's getting at, which is, you know, in Hudson, even though they dismissed, even though they claimed lack of jurisdiction, the Federal Circuit said, listen, you're writing about errors in a procedural errors in a board decision. That's an exercise of original jurisdiction. So even though you dismissed, what you call it is sort of beside the point.
Right. Well, and I think that's why Hudson laid out this particular test. It distinguished Burkhart in saying that Burkhart did not involve a claim where the original jurisdiction decision was erroneous. And so the question is, what does original jurisdiction decision mean? And I think in reading Halpern and Hudson together and their narrow understanding, it must mean the underlying decision, as in there was something wrong.
Yeah, no, but maybe it's easier to think about when you think of like a lack of jurisdiction, right? Now, a lack of jurisdiction means the court has no legal authority to do anything, right? And so if you look at the original memdeck, we basically got a joint motion to vacate a decision for lack of jurisdiction, which we vacated, right? And then because of the case law, you know, the practice was we dismissed it, right? If we truly lack jurisdiction, the VA could have ignored our order. It would be ultra vires. It is no legal. There's no legal effect. That's what lack of jurisdiction means. Like what Judge Jakewith meant. If somebody tries to appeal a criminal conviction in our court, that's an example of having no jurisdiction.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I think Judge Jakewith pointed out that in all of these cases, in Hudson, Halpern, Burkhart, and Greenidge now, the board and the Veterans Court would have subject matter jurisdiction over these veterans benefits claims. And if we're going to actually a jurisdictional decision, in all of these cases, in the Q claims at least, these are simply premature. But the important thing, I think, in distinguishing Halpern and Hudson was that the court could not dismiss alone. There was something else for the court to do with that dismissal to rectify an original jurisdiction error.
I think you're thinking more of the prevailing party calculus about what's left to do, right? Or if you're thinking of the remedy, I mean, basically, the act of like this, and this is why Hudson, like, the terminology is important, which is Hudson basically said, listen, we lack jurisdiction to, I forget what the, was it? That was the SOC one.
That was correct. It was the SOC, but also that the original jurisdiction decision failed to adjudicate under the proper standard under 3.156A.
Right. They had a new material thing. But it was really like the board just said, listen, it was untimely because you never filed an NOD or something. So we basically said the board kind of jumped the gun. They just sort of on their own did this. That was without jurisdiction. So we lack jurisdiction, but while we're at it, we order the board to reconsider it, right? And the Federal Circuit said, listen, like that's an exercise of jurisdiction. And so there's nothing, I mean, the board could have ignored it. I mean, that would be what you do with lack of jurisdiction, but there was something left to do, which is re-adjudicate it.
Correct. And I think, as I said, I think that's the distinguishing point. But then we get to Halpern, which if you go to the court's order in Halpern, that one, the court granted the unopposed motion to vacate for want of original jurisdiction, noting that the matter was remanded to the board with directions to dismiss as referred to the board by the regional office.
Right. But here, I signed a joint decree. Like the idea was vacate the decision. Like that's something to do.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think that had the remedy there had nothing to do with the first part of this test, which was an error in an original jurisdiction decision. In Halpern, if that case was simply dismissed without referral, that attorney fees claim would have terminated. So to ensure that claim stayed alive, the court had to, in its dismissal order, include additional instruction to fix that original jurisdiction error, the original jurisdiction being the board decision in Halpern. And the same thing happened in Hudson, which was after the court got a hold of it, it noted that essentially, even though we're dismissing, this is in fact a remand for the RO to issue an SOC and as well as adjudicate under the correct new material evidence standard. Compare that, though, to our Q claims that we have here. There's nothing left for the agency to do following the dismissals, both in Burkhart, which was the non-final June 1946 decision. There was nothing for the agency to do.
What does finality even mean, right? Like, finality under the APA means that the agency has culminated, like they've finished the decision-making process, right? Whereas in Burkhart, like, nobody claimed that just because they hadn't provided notice that, like, VA was still deciding this claim from 1947. They hadn't, like, finally reached a decision. What's happening, what we're talking about is basically everything you're describing. These are exercises of jurisdiction, right? That's exercises of original jurisdiction where you take action, there's a final board decision, so that triggers our jurisdiction, and then we're assessing the propriety of that decision and then pointing out errors. And we're getting caught up on, and that's why I asked Mr. Carpenter about the technicalities. Just because we dismiss something, if we're effectively correcting errors and then VA is going to take action on, that's an exercise of jurisdiction. How is that not?
Because we have the Federal Circuit's holding in Burkhart, which essentially says there was no jurisdiction in that case, and there was no jurisdiction over the EJA. And so we have to, I believe the responsibility we have here is to find the light between Burkhart scenarios and
Let me ask you this, and I recognize that Group 7's not the counsel in front of the Federal Circuit, right? But basically, the order signed by the secretary, remanding it, asks us to address Halpern without conceding error. And you're here arguing that Halpern's irrelevant. With Halpern, they basically said the board failed. They had proper jurisdiction because there's a final board decision. They failed to look at their own jurisdiction, which just basically hinges on, is there a final board decision? Does it involve veterans' benefits?
Right. Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that we're saying it's not applicable. We're saying it's distinguishable. And there are a few reasons why I think that the original EJA decision in this case that you made is the correct one, but with the important nuance that this Halpern case, which seems very close, is distinguishable for the reasons the Secretary has set out, that there is no error in original jurisdiction decision that requires further agency action along with the court's dismissal. And
again, the further agency, when I say vacate a decision, it doesn't automatically vacate. I'm ordering the Secretary to vacate a decision. I'm not going to, like, I can't walk down there and make the decision go away. That's a remedy. How is that not further?
This goes back to Burkhart, which in that case, the vacate and dismiss order, and I believe the language from the court's order there was simply that the board's decision is dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. That short order the Federal Circuit said did not confer EJA jurisdiction.
Here's how I read Burkhart, which is you look closely at it, and the party in Burkhart never kind of challenged, like, the whole thing is premised on the derivative jurisdiction that, where the board lacks jurisdiction, the court lacks jurisdiction. And if you read it, the counsel for the Burkhart never challenges that. He says, even though the court may have lacked actual jurisdiction, it had potential jurisdiction. And that's what, and then he just asked them to do kind of basic statutory analysis of EJA. So none of the statutory analysis is obviously fine, but it seems like what Hudson and Halpern rejected was the whole premise of that what's effectively an exercise of jurisdiction. If the end result of that is to find out that the board lacked jurisdiction, the whole legs are cut off, the whole thing. That seems to be what Hudson and Halpern have rejected, which is the overall premise.
Well, to me, though, Hudson and Halpern were presented with a difficulty that they had to fix something below, even though they lacked albeit jurisdiction. They found that essentially they did have jurisdiction because they had to fix this original jurisdiction decision error. And that sets those cases apart from these premature Q claims like we have here in Greenidge.
But in Burkhart, the jurisdiction, the problem was lack of notice. That was something that was identified by the court, right? Like, obviously, that would change the effective date. I mean, there's, you know, different, I don't know, maybe they could order to provide notice, but there's definitely post-decisional action. Because, again, like, lack of jurisdiction means VA could just ignore it. It would be an ultra vires decision.
And this is why I believe it's important that the court's order to dismiss is the one directing the agency to take the action. Because in Burkhart, even though there was the finding that there was no finality, that decision is now non-final. And appellant can appeal it if they choose. Just as in Greenidge, where the court found that IRQ claim had not been, there's no NOD, appellant after this dismissal could freely submit that NOD, which he did in January 2021. So it's just in Hudson and Halpern. In Halpern, for instance, the June 1999 board decision that denied attorney's fees was the original jurisdiction decision. And the court's dismiss noted that it was referred to the agency of original jurisdiction for adjudication. So in my mind, there was something, the court had to order that back to the AOJ in that dismissal order so that something could be done. As in, it did have jurisdiction to take the action it did when it was ordering to dismiss.
We could basically just vacate and order the board to send it back. I mean, the Federal Circuit does it all the time to us, where they'll vacate a decision and they'll tell us to remand to the board. I mean, I don't see why we couldn't. And then, you know, the person wants to appeal it or whatever the next step is, that's kind of their business. But I don't see how that would affect jurisdiction.
I think the only reason it makes lines up is because of the language in Hudson. First Hudson, then second Halpern. And Hudson, it laid out that Burkhart was distinguishable from the fact pattern in that case because that case Burkhart did not involve a claim where an original jurisdiction decision was erroneous. I think that's at 1363. But then you get Halpern, where the Federal Circuit essentially says the same thing. This Hudson confirms our result here. Because there was an error in an original jurisdiction decision in Halpern in that the board erred by adjudicating this in the first instance, there is EJA jurisdiction because our order stipulates there are further agency action required with our dismissal.
What do you make of 7261?
I think 7261, as you mentioned, I believe it was you who mentioned, provides this court with the authority to vacate. But vacating a case alone does not confer jurisdiction over the merits or the EJA.
I mean, what? So we seem to be, it's almost like the principle of non-contradiction here, right? Which is you can't exercise jurisdiction and not exercise jurisdiction at the same time, right? Which is 7261C3, I don't have it in front of me, basically says we have the authority to set aside decisions where the board acts in excess of its jurisdiction, right? If our jurisdiction were on all fours with the boards, that would be impossible. Like, how is that possible? Where would we be getting the jurisdiction that we could dismiss cases from the excess?
I think this goes back to the Federal Circuit's holding in Burkhart. I believe you can read Burkhart as harmonizing with Halpern and Hudson with an understanding that Hudson and Halpern are narrow. And I, going to this jurisdictional question, I think it's tricky, admittedly, because at the end of the day, as I said, the board is always going to have subject matter jurisdiction over veterans' claims. And so the distinction of whether there's lacking actual versus lacking potential.
So isn't what we're doing making that simple concept tricky by focusing on the intricacies of individual merits permutations? If we go back and focus on the elements of a successful EJA claim, there's only two, I think, that are at issue in this case, right? The prevailing party element, which we haven't talked about and maybe won't. And then in a court having jurisdiction of that action. But we keep talking about it as if that action is what happens at the board what happens at the RO, what we can do with and for those situations. But Halpern makes it very clear that that's not the question. It's a question that's almost always answered yes, or should be almost always answered yes, because of 7252. It is just as simple as we've been talking about. Board decision affecting benefits equals we have appellate jurisdiction. That's what Halpern found, and that's what the Supreme Court has suggested is the case in Scarborough. And we're engaging in, aren't we engaging in the kind of expansive, amorphous talk about jurisdiction that the Supreme Court has decried in a series of cases, Condrick, Arbaugh, Union Pacific, Wilkins, most recently, Judge Toth chronicled in our Hall decision. And we can't see the forest for the trees. We're running from tree to tree.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I think that the frustration with understanding where there is jurisdiction leads that the test here in deciding how to harmonize Burkhart with Halpern and Hudson is that it can't rely on this understanding of jurisdiction alone. There has to be something else, another piece there, that demonstrates where there is EJA jurisdiction in Halpern and Hudson cases and when there is not EJA jurisdiction in these Burkhart and Greenidge cases. And the Secretary believes that the dividing line there has to do with the individual errors in the original jurisdiction decisions in those cases. As I said, in Halpern, the error was that the board adjudicated that initially. It should have been the AOJ. In Hudson, the error was that the regional office adjudicated that on the incorrect new material evidence standard under 3.156A. The court, when it ordered dismissal, effectively ordered further agency actions to rectify those errors to keep appellant in the same position. And so it's the Secretary's understanding that the jurisdictional analysis is not a question of whether there's potential or actual jurisdiction, but instead what the court was doing when it ordered to dismiss and what happened below. And I think this issue with the counsel for the appellant noted that it's these errors that the court addresses in these dismissal orders that essentially, affect as remands, but we agree there, confer jurisdiction over EJA. And that's why I think these Hudson and Halpern situations are more narrow, because it's not often that the court would have to intervene to dismiss with additional agency instruction. And here,
but how do you reconcile that with these cases that say the jurisdiction we're talking about is the jurisdiction to hear the case, which we unquestionably have?
I read that to mean that in Burkhart and Greenidge situations, because there's nothing for the court to do but dismiss, there is no jurisdiction. But in those cases,
well, we have to exercise jurisdiction to do that, as Judge Toth has been speaking to you about for 20 minutes.
Respectfully, I trying to read Burkhart and Halpern and Hudson together. And I admit that it's difficult because these are jurisdictional
questions. That's because of some slippage in the underlying Burkhart, the Burkhart at our court, of the sort that has been happening in courts all around the country that has caused the Supreme Court to scold us. And I think they've done it too. They've recognized in that instead of just deciding the very simple question of, is this a case we can hear? The court in Burkhart below said we had to be able to award the relief sought to have jurisdiction. Well, that's just not right for EJA purposes. That may be jurisdiction in little tiny letters, small j, something, but it's not really jurisdictional in the way that Judge Toth has been talking to you.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I guess I disagree in the sense that Burkhart was stipulated on this jurisdictional analysis alone that I agree is a slippery slope. Instead, I think the bright line rule that sets apart Burkhart and Greenidge here with the narrow situations in Halpern and Hudson is that the court's dismissal order sought to rectify an original jurisdiction decision error. And those situations are rare. We see that in not applicable here in Greenidge, because the appellant in this case notwithstanding the court's order to dismiss alone, was still able to appeal that IRQ claim in January 2021, and that appeal is still pending before the board as of November 17th, 2023. I think that this court is bound by federal... The court has to try to find the harmony between Burkhart, Halpern, and Hudson, and the secretary believes that harmony is found in this test, which is there an error in the original jurisdiction decision that was discussed in Hudson? And second, whether the court's dismissal required further agency action as it did in Halpern and as it did in Hudson.
But there's nothing in Burkhart or Halpern that tries to make the reconciliation you've described. That's all you.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would concede that Hudson cites to Burkhart and Halpern's, the Federal Circuit and Halpern confirmed that Hudson confirmed the result there.
And Halpern cites to Burkhart too. The same judge wrote both decisions.
Correct. Burkhart was and Halpern were both written by Judge Lynn. That's correct. And that's why I think you can find harmony between these two cases. These are not cases that are disagreeing with one another. I think you can find the harmony if you look for an original jurisdiction decision that has error that the court's dismissal order requires the agency to fix somehow. Because otherwise, if we go back to Halpern and Hudson, if we go back to Halpern and the court didn't reference this referral, I believe that attorney fees case would have been terminated. And so the requirement that the court dismissed with that instruction, the reference to referral, ensured that that claim continued. Similarly, in Hudson, there was the issuance of the SOC issue as well as the adjudication under the correct new material evidence standard. Both of those errors were referenced in the court's order to dismiss. Now, the Federal Circuit held that the dismissal worked, in fact, as a remand. But I think we can agree that if this were a remand alone for the SOC, that necessarily wouldn't have fixed the new material evidence error that was committed below. And that's why I think those two cases are set apart from these Burkhart and Greenidge cases, these premature Q claims, where there is no error in the original jurisdiction decision. I think while the June 1946 Burkhart decision was non-final, there was nothing left for the agency to do to put appellant in the same position he would have been in but for the court's dismissal. And similarly here in Greenidge, the February 1993 decision, there was nothing left for the court to do following dismissal. And as I said, appellant was able to appeal that through an NOD in January 2021.
No, but it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't. So if I were the secretary, I mean, if you wanted to be bold, right, what you should do when we dismiss a case for lack of jurisdiction is simply do nothing. Because honestly, our admission that we lack jurisdiction means anything we technically said would be ultra vires about the impropriety, any procedural errors we pointed out, any lack of notice, any of that. It would just be a nullity. I mean, that's what lack of jurisdiction means. And I think that's the point Hudson's getting at, which is, listen, like, even though the court is using this technical terminology of dismissing and lack of jurisdiction, what it's doing is pointing out errors in a board decision and ordering the board to basically address those errors and rectify them. And it can disclaim jurisdiction all at once. That's an exercise of jurisdiction. That's why it uses the term effect. I think it was effectively remands is what it said, even though it's dismissing. And I just, again, I can't square these exercises of jurisdiction with the non-exercise of jurisdiction.
I agree, Your Honor. I don't think you can, if you look through this, the jurisdictional lens, I don't think you can square them. I think the way you have to square them is looking to this original jurisdiction decision error that Hudson mentions, as well as what the court is actually doing. I think we agree on that point. I think in all these cases where the Federal Circuit found there was jurisdiction, the court was spurring agency action, was spurring something else besides just dismissing the board decision. But in Burkhart, and in the Greenidge case, in Burkhart, the simple dismissal
agency action
did not confer EJA jurisdiction.
Right. I mean, here again, it's you know, it's a single judge decision with the parties agreeing. I'm not going to send it to a panel. And so I just kind of do what the court has always done, which is I vacated the lower court decision, which itself is an exercise of jurisdiction. And then I dismiss because that's the court's practice. Those are actually mutually incompatible if you look closely. But I want to ask about something I normally never would, but I think it's which is about the remand order from the Federal Circuit, right? And I know, you know, you didn't draft it, but why? I mean, it's the oddest thing where you're now defending my decision to me after you've requested me to reconsider my own decision in light of their, why not just keep it up at the Federal Circuit? Why not ask them to sort out their own precedent? Why ask us to do this?
There are a few things, Your Honor. First, as I keep saying, I think Hudson and Halpern can be harmonized with Burkhart. And I think that's an important distinction for these EJIA jurisdictions.
Why do you want me to do that? Like the Federal Circuit, you're up there. There's their cases. Why not have them sort it all out?
Right. These are all Federal Circuit cases, Your Honor. That's correct. I think it's the court's job here is to just be to note the harmony between those cases. But I'll note that the Secretary in his original EJIA response noted that there was at least some tension between.
You know, why? I mean, the language of the remand order is basically like the Veterans Court did not address relevant binding precedent from this court. I mean, it sounds like a JMR for reasons and bases. Like, we don't have a reasons and bases requirement. You're up in front of the Federal Circuit. Why not, you know, if I, you know, failed to address precedent, like, have at it. You can have them reverse or they can sort out the. But why basically open this and then come down here? And now you've been forced to kind of defend a precedent that I think is now unquestioned. You know, why do all this?
For two reasons, Your Honor. I think, well, first, as this is an important distinction that even though the Federal Circuit can make it, I think we can make it again here first. And second, because of the pleadings. First, the Secretary mentioned Halpern in the original EJIA response. And second, I believe your memorandum decision on this EJIA noted that the case law was unequivocal. I think it might have been strongly worded because, as I noted, I think Halpern and Hudson are distinguishable, but they are there. And there are these situations where dismissal from this court can confer jurisdiction over the EJIA, as I noted in those rare situations where there's an original jurisdiction decision error, where the court's dismissal spurs further agency action, like in this case, like in Hudson and Halpern. But that was not present in this case. And as you noted, Department of Justice represents the Secretary at the Federal Circuit. And so those decisions there are not mine. Personally.
Anything else, Judge Jakewith?
Do you think that in Halpern, the Federal Circuit may have avoided this confusion because they got focused input from our court in Judge Steinberg's concurrence rather than the slippage to focusing on awarding the relief sought that happened in Burkhart? Judge Steinberg clearly set out what becomes really the Federal Circuit's decision in Halpern, that there's no question that the court had jurisdiction to take the action it took in vacating the board decision. And even though it never could have lawfully exercised jurisdiction over the merits of the underlying attorney fee agreement decision. And that's the end of that question. Then you turn to the prevailing party issue and the other associated elements of a successful EJIA claim.
Yeah, Your Honor, correct. The court's concurrence in Halpern stated the court had jurisdiction to grant appellant's unopposed motion to remand at the time of the filing to ensure the board would dismiss the matter and return it to the appropriate VA regional office below. And I think that gets back to there was further agency action required along with the court's dismissal that conferred jurisdiction. And that's a rare situation. And I think that those rare situations were unique. And that's why these Halpern and Hudson situations are narrow and haven't necessarily come up as frequently as they would in these premature Q claims that are adjudicated by the board in both Greenidge and in Burkhart.
What is the order you would like us to enter? What's the holding?
The holding would be, as Judge Toth wrote originally, with the distinction as to why Halpern and Hudson are narrow situations that would not apply to this case because there is no error in the original jurisdiction decision that requires no further agency action with the court's dismissal.
Anything else, Judge Toth?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
No, Judge Jakewith?
No, thank you, Judge Greenberg.
All right. Anything else from the government? Don't mean to cut you off. You have a few seconds left. You'd like to summarize?
In conclusion, the secretary again requests that the court dismiss this EJIA application for lack of jurisdiction. But even if the court decides there is jurisdiction, it should deny the EJIA application because appellant is not a prevailing party.
Thank you very much. We'll hear the rebuttal from counsel for the appellant. Go ahead.
If I could begin with Judge Toth's inquiry about what happened at the Federal Circuit, I recognize, too, that it's somewhat beyond the scope of why we're here. But it's why we're here. I will tell you in candor, when I got the call from the Department of Justice that they wanted to move to send this matter back, I had to take several days to see what it was that was going on. And they laid out, as they did in their motion, what their reasoning was. Of course, I was then professionally embarrassed because Halperin was my case. I was looking at Halperin through a completely different lens, but frankly, once they pointed it out to me, it seemed to me that Halperin was on point. But I want to be clear, this was not a joint remand. I did not join in the motion. I did not oppose the motion. My personal view, had I been asked by the Federal Circuit, would have been on behalf of my client that the case is here. These are Federal Circuit cases. It should be disposed of based upon those Federal Circuit cases. But that was not an opportunity that I was afforded. The court granted that motion. And I believe that the reason that they granted that motion, in all candor, Your Honor, is that you simply did not address Halperin. And therefore, that put the secretary in the position of being in a non-defensible position that Halperin didn't apply. And so the secretary could write a brief to the court saying that you made an error and it should go back to discuss Halperin. They decided that the path of least resistance was to move to vacate the appeal and return it for consideration. But I would now like to move on, unless there's any questions about that from the panel. Okay. It seems to me that the government has lost complete focus in their argument by asking for this court to affirm what was clear error in this court's decision to dismiss the EJIA, but the application of Mr. Greenridge. It's simply not a basis that has any factual or legal basis to be affirmed. This court had jurisdiction because, as you have indicated, Judge Toth, when you vacated, you took jurisdiction. You can't take jurisdiction and not take jurisdiction. So if this court had jurisdiction, as the court found in Hudson and in Halperin, then this court has jurisdiction over the EJIA application. But the focus that I'm concerned about from the government's point of view is that they're not looking at the fact that when an adversely affected appellant appeals to this court, they need a remedy. And this court is the only resource for that remedy. And that remedy in this case was to vacate, but also to direct the board to only exercise jurisdiction when there was a notice of disagreement. There was simply no disagreement. Why they took jurisdiction is simply incomprehensible. But they did, and they addressed it as though it were a continuing Q claim. The NOD was on the rating assigned in the revised decision. That had nothing to do with Q. The board in the second round, in the decision that was appealed to this court, was dealing with Q. Q had been resolved. It was the rating assigned that was being appealed and was timely appealed within the 1 year of that decision that revised the, I think it's 1993 decision.
Yeah, can I ask you about that? Because I think this is what I was getting at with the prevailing party, which is I think the facts of this might be important. So you had the Q decision, and then the board kind of sua sponte went and just adjudicated it, and then we vacated that. And then what happened afterwards?
Well, nothing has happened afterwards. I checked with the counsel below and with the representative below, and absolutely nothing has happened. And I think part of the problem here was is that the board misread the procedural history and thought that the Q case was still pending. But the Q case had been resolved. There had been a finding of Q, a revision, the assignment of an earlier effective date. And when they assigned the earlier effective date, they assigned the same 10% rating. Once that decision was revised and the rating was assigned, Mr. Greenwich was afforded the right to challenge that rating, which he did with an NOD. The board prematurely intervened and jumped in to deal with the Q disposition. The Q disposition had been decided by the agency of original jurisdiction. Q was over. We were on the revised decision that was coming back. And that, I promised I wasn't going to get into prevailing party. That's why he was a prevailing party, because he got a premature decision from the board that prevented him from exercising his right of administrative appellate review on the 10% rating assigned. So there was a material alteration in the relationship of the parties. So he clearly meets the criteria for prevailing party, which we could clearly litigate once this court corrects that decision.
So you mentioned earlier on the that you think we shouldn't get to that, though. So, obviously, if we do...
Not in this decision, Your Honor.
Well, why not?
I mean, we'd be deciding
that we have jurisdiction, and then we'd
just,
have to...
Just like you couldn't take jurisdiction and not take jurisdiction, all that's before this court is whether or not you correctly decided to dismiss the EJL application for lack of jurisdiction.
You're saying the terms of the remand basically only allow us to comment on the propriety of our decision not to take jurisdiction over it.
Yes. Well, that was the final decision that was appealed to the Federal Circuit. When the Secretary made his motion to vacate that appeal.
It's back here. I mean, this is, here we are, right?
But at least thus far, this court hasn't issued an order saying that the original decision was incorrect. If the original decision was incorrect, then this court should have made a decision on the merits of the EJA application. So
we have to vacate the earlier decision.
The underlying decision said there was no jurisdiction for EJA.
Right. I asked before. I mean, there's a lot of case law and there's a lot of technical things that we may have to move to grant relief.
Well, I'm not sure there is, Your Honor. To me, it's a fairly simple proposition that this court was either correct that it had no jurisdiction to entertain his EJA application. The court incorrectly decided that.
Yeah, right. So
that decision must be vacated.
Would correct that decision, and then we would do what you always do when you have jurisdiction. We would decide that we would check the propriety of the matter as to the EJA.
Well, address the merits of the EJA application,
right,
for which there has been no decision. Once there is a final disposition of that, if you agree with the government there was no prevailing party, then we will go back to the Federal Circuit and litigate whether there was a prevailing party.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, no, I think we're clear.
Okay. Thank you. I have
anything
nothing further.
Judge Jacobs?
No, thank you.
Mr. Carpenter, you've got a few minutes, minute and a half. You'd like to – you done?
I'm done, Your Honor.
All right. Anything more, Judge Toth?
No, thanks.
Okay. Well, we'd like to thank counsel for their excellent detailed presentations, both in writing and here in the argument. And we'll consider the case submitted. Thank you all.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is in recess. Sorry.
The court is in recess.